Welcome back to Springwood, my Fredhead friends. It's time for Welcome to Primetime, a Freddy's Nightmares podcast. And this is a very special episode because we have Freddy's Nightmares executive producer, Jeff Freilich, here to talk all about his career and, of course, his involvement with our beloved program. And we're going to get to part one, which is mostly about the buildup of his career. And then we get into Freddy's Nightmares. So make sure you kick back and enjoy the interview. It is a great one. This is a big moment for us, Double D.
Yes, it is.
I've been looking forward to this ever since it was even possibly put on the table. So do you want to do the intro?
Because
I'm always the loudmouth.
I would love to. So we have with us Mr. Jeff Freilich. You were the producer, writer on Freddy's Nightmares. You have such quite a resume. And first off, thank you so much for coming on to the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I love your podcast. I think it's wonderful that you're keeping alive something that I am so ashamed of in my past. So I think it's all because of you. But no, you most entertaining podcast I've heard in a very long time. So I appreciate you.
We Thank appreciate you. That.
Well, so before we dive into that, because there's so much to talk about.
Yes.
Because, I mean, since you've listened to some of the show, you know we're just the biggest movie nerds and TV nerds out there. So we'd love to talk a little bit about how you got your start, because you've had a very interesting career, even pre-Freddy and post-Freddy. You've had so many cool things happen. So how did it all start?
I grew up in the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and my closest friends, a couple of them, were sons of celebrated but blacklisted screenwriters. One was Tim Hunter, whose father, Ian McClellan Hunter, was later blacklisted but had received the Oscar for Roman Holiday, even though he fronted it for Dalton Trumbo.
Yep.
Trumbo being very close friends of the Hunters. Ian was a terrific guy, and Ian actually helped mentor me as a writer. He wrote my student speeches when I would run for for student government. I'd go to Ian Hunter's house, I'd go to Tim's house, and Ian would read the speech and make it so good that only the teachers liked it. The other close friend of mine was Jimmy Lardner, who was Ring Lardner Jr.'s son. Ring Lardner Jr. had won an Oscar for a movie called Woman of the Year, and then 29 years later, after going to jail as one of the Hollywood 10, finally got another crack at writing with his own name and wrote the movie MASH, for which he won another Oscar at the age of 58, and had one of the greatest and most succinct Oscar speeches in history when he got up in 1969 and he said, because he really was not a big fan of the Academy or the people in it, who almost ruined his life. He got up and he said, for the first time in my life, this is verbatim, he said, for the first time in my life, I've established a pattern. Every 29 years, I won an Academy Award in 1998, and he'd walked off the stage. And that was that.
Perfect.
That was 1969. But between Jimmy and Tim, I was, and Johnny Kaplan, who is a kid who really wanted to be a filmmaker. That was our poker game. And Josh Mostel, Zero's son, and a couple of other people who were all part of the same kind of Upper West Side film community, the New York film community. So Tim and I became best friends, and I had told everybody that I was going to be a doctor. So every adult that I knew, from my parents to my grandparents to friends of each of them, were proud and felt secure that the rest of my life was going to be taken care of. You go to medical school, you always have a job, don't worry about it. Boom. So I went to the wrong school for that. I applied to a bunch of colleges, got in to a few of them, but I loved the idea of Antioch College, which was a small and politically actually quite radical school in a very small town in southwestern Ohio called Yellow Springs, which is about 25 miles from where you are now.
Yeah. Yep. The home of Dave Chappelle.
Dave Chappelle lives there, of all yep. people. Can't believe it. I heard my daughter tell me that the other night. I was like, what?
Oh, yeah.
Why Yellow Springs?
You can run into Dave Chappelle in downtown like on Friday nights. Easily. He's out drinking and stuff.
Yeah. It's so bizarre because when we were there, you know, the school had 3,500 students when I was there, which is like 1,000 times more than it has now, and a population of about 1,000. So the town itself was mostly students, and most of the stores on the main street were for students. And if you drove or you rode a bicycle a couple of miles out of town to the dairy, you could get fresh ice cream. But aside from that, there was a donut store and a general store. It was not much. But I went to Antioch because I was attracted to what was the work-study program. It was a five-year college with no vacations, except maybe 2 weeks over Christmas. And in those 5 years, every year, you spent 6 months working somewhere in either three-month blocks or six-month blocks, or going to school. And the idea was that you would take a job either in the areas that best, you know, led you toward your career goal, or in areas that you wanted to become familiar with and check off your list or, you know, embrace. And so I had a variety of different jobs. I won't go into all of that. It's kind of dull. But while I was there, I made some films. And I ran the Film Society, and we had a 2,000-seat auditorium. It was fantastic, with great 35-millimeter projection, arc projectors. And we also had a very wonderful movie theater in town called The Little Art. I don't know if that's still there or not.
They redid it a couple of years, maybe five or six years ago. Yeah. They did like a big fundraiser and brought it back. Now they serve wine and popcorn at the same time.
It was cool. It was the closest thing to a Cinematheque that you could find. And Mark, you know, keep in mind that I went to college from 1964 to 1969. So it was just at the beginning of the Vietnam War, right into the heat of the protests, the women's movement, launched by the Equal Rights Amendment, marches on Washington that we were, you know, like on the constantly going to every couple of months. It was a very volatile time, but at the same time, this was an incredibly idyllic place to be. And I spent a lot of my time making and showing films, and I started a film festival that rivaled the one in Ann Arbor. Because Tim Hunter, my best friend from high school, had gone off to Harvard, and he started the Harvard Film Society and started doing the film festival there. So we were at Sheer Films. I showed all of Tim's original films at Antioch, and his film starred his roommate, Tommy Lee Jones. So it was like, you know, a lot of people's careers started in those days. And but I went on to medical school. I really had no confidence and by being able to, you know, it wasn't even a confidence issue. I had no desire at that point to get into the film industry. I did take one writing course. You have to remember that in the late 60s, there were no film schools. NYU was just starting it. Haig Manoogian was just opening up the Tisch NYU Film School. AFI was an idea, and the first AFI really was launched in I think, Maryland or Washington, D.C. There wasn't any interest in learning academically about film, and film is expensive. We had to make film on film. So, and the average student couldn't afford to make a movie because the process was so expensive and so long. We didn't have the equipment. And then to make a print, you know, there wasn't a corner store to go down with your film and say, here, make me a print. So it was something that only very special people were dedicated to. I had several friends at Antioch who went off and helped the Mather brothers make the, you know, Give Me Shelter movie. Reichardt, who is a great Oscar-winning documentarian, who Julia died a year or two ago. Mm-hmm. I think last year she died, but she was in that class also. Those were serious filmmakers. I was not that person. I made a takeoff on Godard called Waiting for Godard. I made a kind of a jungle movie based on a series of films that I was showing at the Saturday night festival that, you know, every week was you get as stoned and drunk as you could, and you went to what we called the Festival of Garbage. And I would show the worst film I could find on a Saturday night. Friday night was reserved for things like The King Must Die, you know, find something really, you know, La Strada, you know, that kind of stuff. Or Le Mépris, speaking of Godard, which is contempt. But while I was there, I walked into the Union Building one day, and on the wall, there was a little sheet that said, sign up Antioch alumnus teaching writing for film and television. Didn't say anything about who it was, what the course was, anything else. Nobody signed up for it. I signed up for it. I was one of finally six people who signed up for it. It was being held in the auditorium. And I was wondering why the auditorium, the six of us, you know, you can barely hear anybody from the stage. So naturally, you know, as college students do, I got into the auditorium. Everybody was sitting as far away from each other as they possibly could. Nobody sat together, right? And there was one older woman back there, and who was a townie from Xenia, the town that got blown away by the tornado and then grew back again.
Oh yeah,
and she was a promising writer. And onto the stage comes Rod Serling, who was an alumnus of Antioch. And he looked out there, and he looked exactly like he did on the beginning of Twilight Zone episode, wearing a black suit and a tie that was undone, that was about a half an inch wide, and a cigarette in his hand. And he looked at it and he said, well, I guess everybody who really wants to learn to write came. Why don't you all move forward? And so for, you know, a period of several weeks, there was a kind of a symposium where he would comment on things that we wrote and give us assignments. And that was kind of the beginning of it. And what I got more out of those days than anything else were a couple of rules to live by in writing. One of my favorites was that every dramatic scene is an argument, but the first question you ask yourself is why are both sides right? That's what tension is about. That's what dramatic tension is about. That if you heavily weigh it on one side or the other, then the audience loses interest because there's no debate. You know, you're guiding somebody down a certain path, which I thought was very interesting. And the other thing that he said, which a later writing partner of mine reinforced, was that things should mean, you know, what you write should mean something. Now, it doesn't mean that everything has to have a strong message. And as we all know, when you look at Twilight Zones, every single one of them was a morality play. And yet, they were incredibly entertaining and twisty and fantastic. But at the same time, you walked away with a lesson that you learned and something to think about and something to argue about, right? So I applied to a whole bunch of medical schools and got into a few, but USC was two things. First of all, it was as far away from my parents in New York as I could get, which was part of the whole growing up. I skipped the part that I started college when I was 15. And I always felt really young. And that's why 5-year college was better for me too. So by the time I got out, at least I was an adult. I still couldn't drink, but I was 20, but I could, you know. And the other thing about going to SC was that it was in California. And I gravitated toward that business. And my friend Tim had gotten into and was starting off at the American Film Institute, which was brand new at the Greystone Mansion in Beverly Hills at the time. And so I, you know, it gave me an opportunity to spend time with him. He was the only person that I knew in town. I went to SD. And at the end of the first year, I left med school the first time. I did it a few times. And went to AFI and produced Tim's thesis film, which starred Bob Random and Charles McGraw. Charles McGraw, if you recall, Spartacus was the guy who taught all of the gladiators how to fight.
Okay.
Rough voice like that, yep, right? Yep. He also played the mayor in The Birds for Hitchcock, although almost all of his dialogue was cut out, and that's a funny anecdote on its own. Bob Random was alternating working on our movie, which we shot up in Seattle, Washington, and on Whidbey Island, with The Other Side of the Wind that Orson Welles was making. It was the last film that he never completed, that Peter Bogdanovich completed only a few years ago. So we'd go visit Bob there, and Bob would finally come up with us. And he was a really fine actor, but his triumph, well, I think he got caught in that. He's just like James Dean kind of mod. You know, it's always difficult to be compared to somebody else who's so incredibly iconic and legendary, because you're always going to be second best. But Bob was terrific. But I got a taste of the business there. My job as a producer, George Stevens Jr. at the time ran the AFI. And when I went to George, And by the way, the AFI at the time was, there was really nothing academic about it at all. It was go make movies. It was a pure conservatory, which it tried to remain. But I went to George Stevens, so what do I need to know about producing? He said, you're going to have $25,000, make the movie for that, period. Right?
Yeah,
and
good.
It was 45 minutes, and it was ambitious, and we did. And we had some fantastic people working on it. Howard Smith did a lot of work on it, who then became a terrific editor. Good cinematographers, all really good people working on the movie. But I went back to med school after that. And finally left and decided that I really just wanted to write. And I started writing. I wrote a screenplay, which was really not very good. And then I wrote a couple of other things. And I, because of my relationship with Tim Hunter, I met Christopher Trumbo, who was Dalton Trumbo's son. And Chris and I became very quick friends. He was partnered with a writer named Michael Butler, who is Hugo Butler's son, another blacklisted writer. And Michael and Chris took a particular interest in me. And they were offered two feature films at the same time. One was called The Don Is Dead for Hal Wallace, which was basically Anthony Quinn and a ripoff of The Godfather.
Hmm.
And the other was called Paradise Flat, which was a Western to be shot in Mexico by a very famous Mexican director named Jose Bolaños, whose claim to fame, among many other things, is that he was Marilyn Monroe's last lover. So if you look up Jose Bolaños and Marilyn Monroe in Google, you'll find photographs of the two of them together. And he, oddly enough, looks like Anthony Quinn. And they couldn't do both at the same time. So they got a hold of Jose and they said, listen, we'll guarantee this young writer's work. Let him write it and we'll give him notes and we'll help him rewrite it. So I was a huge fan of Leone, and Leone's Eastwood, early Eastwood movies had come out already. This was early 70s. And so my approach to Westerns was very little dialogue and mostly shot descriptions. I wrote that, and Chris and Michael, who had been writing more commercial feature films and also television, wanted it to read more like one of those. And by the time I was done with my second draft based on them, it read like a TV script. It was a very talky Western. And I sent it down to Mexico City, and Jose never got back to me. It was like dead silence. So I called him a few weeks later. And remember, 1972 or whenever this was, phone calls to Mexico City were expensive. So it was like, and I was a starving, you know, medical dropout. Here I am, you know, knowing just enough medicine to be scared about any symptom that I may have ever. But not knowing what to do about it because I never got to that part of med school, right? So I get a hold of Jose, and Jose said, well, you know, it's not what I thought it would be, the way you described, the way you were going to write it to me. You know, for me, it didn't, you know, it's just a lot of words. I said, listen, I wrote another draft. I wrote the first draft before Chris and Michael got their hands on it. Let me send you that. I did. He responded with tickets to Mexico City and wanted me to come down and not only do a rewrite on that, but write other things. He loved it. It was exactly what he wanted. And I got down to Mexico City, and Jose meets me in the lobby of this hotel, which was right next to the Plaza del Toro, the center of Mexico City, the bullfighting arena. Takes me upstairs, has a whole handful of keys. There's five rooms on the floor. He opens one, he says, this is where you'll sleep. Opens another one, says, this is where you'll work. Another one, he opens up and says, this is where you can entertain guests. Another one, he says, this is where you can put all of your things. And he said, in the other room, why should anybody else share your floor? And then gave me all the keys. Now, the producer of the movie, Tony Fuentes, who had been a stunt double for John Wayne and all of those Westerns that were made in the northern province of Torreon, Mexico,
yeah.
In Durango, you know, with Howard Hawks and John Ford. He had been not a matador, but like a picador, I think. And so he would come and we would watch bullfights from one of the rooms. I don't remember which one it was because I could look right into it. And that was kind of my baptism of fire. And I wrote those, and then came back to Los Angeles, was contacted by somebody that I knew in a rich kid who I knew at Antioch, but I hardly knew him. And he wanted me to write a movie. I don't know why, but he liked the student films I made. And it didn't go anywhere. It didn't get made, but it got to an agent named Bill Hart. Bill Hart was a former agent for William Morris. He packaged and put together Love Story. He got the Eric Siegel book. He got Eric Siegel to make Love Story. He became really a famous agent. And he called me out of the blue, total cold call, and said, come in and meet me. I've read your scripts. Nobody's ever going to make these movies, but I like your dialogue. And I came in at a very propitious time. I skipped a little part, and so we're going to hold on the Bill Hart story. Okay, what I missed was coming back to work with Tim Hunter with Roger Corman. So that's where Bill Hart is the beginning of my television career, and I want to get rid of bad movies that I worked on before that. Tim, and part of the AFI and part of the AFI experience to this day is making connections. And it may not be with other AFI fellows, but it could be with people in the film community, because everybody in the film community kind of gravitates to film schools. You know, you get a lot of interaction. Tim had made friends with Joe Dante and Alan Orfish, and they had gotten hired for their first movie that they were going to co-direct by Roger Corman, called Hollywood Boulevard.
Yes.
In Hollywood Boulevard, which was a movie about making a movie. It was a series of murders where an older actress, older being in her 30s, played by Mary Warrenoff, who is Paul Martel's wife, I believe, systematically kills off, out of jealousy, every young, beautiful ingenue in the film. My favorite murder of all was chopping the wire behind the H on the Hollywood sign and having the H fall on top of this woman like a Bugs Bunny cartoon, and seeing smoke rise out of an H in the ground. Right? It was the best. But Joe had reached out to Tim because they were having problems with the dialogue in the film, and they needed a lot of punch up jokes and some extra stuff. And Tim called me up. He suggested that I would be the right one to do that. And so Tim and I went in together. That's when I first met Joe. We got credits on it. If you look at Hollywood Boulevard, our credits are AFI Observers Lope and Lupe DeVargas. That was Tim Hunter and me.
That's awesome.
And yeah. And so with Roger, John Davidson produced it. John, who went on to produce RoboCop and Airplane and other things. So it was really quite the you know, it was really the little rascals running to the barn saying, let's put on a show. That's what we were basically like. And Joe edited it because that was his forte at the time. And what was really funny is that we realized it was a movie about making a movie, but we never saw what the movie that they were making was. So we put in, next door they were cutting Death Race 2000 and got film off the floor and out of the bin that was never going to be in that movie to intercut into Hollywood Boulevard. And then when Joe got his directing check, I ran this story by Roger. He said, yeah, that's what happened. he screened it, Roger did, and came in and said, kids, that was really a great idea. You put on Death Race footage on the film. It really works great. Thanks. It's just terrific. And the next thing you know, Joe's complaining about his check being less than he was promised. And he went in and Roger said, well, stock footage. So what I learned at Roger's was, you know, that anything can be made for anything if you put your mind to it, that money is not a measure of quality or talent, and you could learn that even better sometimes from people like Sergio Leone. When you look at pictures like his trilogy with Eastwood that he made for nothing, he made a fistful of dollars out of split ends that he had from, you know, ends of film, little empty cans. And he happened to run into Eastwood at some festival in Europe, and Eastwood was a nobody. He'd done Raw. And he was the perfect, you know, American action hero. And just as later on, he thought that the blue eyes on Henry Fonda made him the perfect villain. Nobody ever thought of Fonda that way. But when he made Once Upon a Time in the West, he took the classic villain and made him the hero of that movie. And then he took Fonda and made him the villain. He's a genius, kind of. But money didn't matter. Great craft service didn't matter. I know that Jay Cappy in his interview with, you know, told you that he got bologna sandwiches on Freddy's. That was not true. We had really great catering. We had great catering. What he now realizes is that was craft service. That was not catering. That was not lunch. Okay. Jay wasn't there to be served lunch, right? It was a sandwich. But it wasn't that far off because Freddy's wasn't made for much more than Hollywood Boulevard. So anyway, one last little Corman bit, and then I'll move back onto it. But what I found out from Peter Bogdanovich years later, and we became close friends and made several movies together. When nobody would hire him, we made films together. But he was Roger's assistant. And that's the way he started. And Roger would take off. This is in the late 60s. Roger went to Russia, where they were making, the Soviet Union at the time, where they were making really cool looking sci-fi movies, big space movies, right? For no money. And he'd buy them for $5,000. And the way real estate people do today, where they flip houses, Roger would come back with these Russian things, wipe the dialogue off if there was any, put different music on, and sell them for $25,000 and make a quick 500% profit, right? So he went and he bought this movie and he shows it to the distributors, and Peter's there with him. And it's all men. It's guys jumping out of a spaceship and running left and right with laser guns, and it's tremendous action. It probably was made for 5 rubles. And the distributor said, Roger, this is great, only there's no women in it. You know, if you get women in it, we could distribute this in the United States. So they left. He sent Peter out for one afternoon on the weekend. He said, I'm a friend of Mamie Van Doren's. Get Mamie Van Doren in a mermaid outfit, put her on a rock in Malibu, hire 5 models, have them lying on the rocks around, and have her point. So when the guys run to the right, she's pointing right. And when they run to the left, she's pointing left. And Peter said, well, Roger, you know, look, I could write some words for her and she could say things. And he said, no sound. Because Roger didn't want to spend the money on a sample mixer, right? So just go shoot it, you know, one afternoon. So Peter came back with the footage. They cut it in. It integrated pretty well visually. The guys come back. They watch it. They say, this is great. Only how do they know what to do? She's not saying anything. And Roger turned to Peter and said, yes, Peter, they're not saying anything. How do they know what to do? And Peter and Peter said, it's telepathic. And they went, oh my God, that's genius. So then Peter suggested that he write a narration and record the voiceover, which was very inexpensive. He considered a moviola and do that. And that's the way Peter told me the story. When I talked to Roger 4 years ago, just before the pandemic, and I said, look, the story, he said, no, that's all true. Only Peter and I devised that plan. So he's telling me that they had it planned that it was going to be telepathic. I don't know what the truth is, but I think the story is priceless. Yeah. And as a result of it, and the result of Peter bailing Roger out and actually helping him and making that movie even more valuable, it was why Roger offered Peter all the second unit work on Wild Angels, which was the Bruce Dern, Diane Ladd. That's the Laura Dern told me she was conceived during that movie on the back of a motorcycle.
I feel like a lot of people were.
So Peter wrote, you know, when Peter went off and shot all of the second unit, you have to assume, you know, looking at the movie, 75% of it is second unit. It's all action stuff on motorcycles. Peter did most of that. And as a result of that, he got Targets. And after Targets, which is the movie that really launched his career as a feature writer director, he went on then to do Last Picture Show. So that's Corman for now. Although there's probably a zillion other good Corman stories to be told. But going back to Bill Hart, who had read all the script, at the same time as Bill called, I got one of those. Remember IBM punch cards? You're probably too young for this, but you used to get in the mail like an IBM punch card and would have, like, in my case, I had a map of the United States with like 500 dots on it. And it said, "We will find you anywhere." And it was from the New York State higher education people who had lent me the money to go to medical school that I had defaulted on. I got to tell you, after years of medical school and after leaving it a few times, I forgot that I owed them money. And suddenly it was like, oh, now look, in 2023, I would have owed them $150,000. Back then, it was more like $7,500.
Yeah.
So it wasn't so bad, but, you know, inflation.
Yeah, that's
a lot of money. So I was desperate for money. So when I went to meet with Bill Hart, he said, "Do you want to write movies?" I said, "I need to write something that pays me tomorrow." Right. And he said, "Television." He said, "That's the quickest way to make money." And he said, "And as a writer, it's one of the most satisfying things to do because you actually get to see it made."
Yeah.
So he got me an appointment with the guys who had created Ben Casey years before, and they had a new show on because I had gone through medical school and I had, you know, neurology and neurosurgery were things that particularly interested me. There was a new series called Doctor's Hospital on NBC, shot at Universal, that starred George Peppard, who I had loved in Breakfast at Tiffany's and other things.
Yeah.
And he was playing a neurosurgeon. And that was, and I went in and I pitched a bunch of ideas. And they turned to the head writer and they said, "He's going to have your job soon." And it's only not because my writing was so good, but because I knew things that they didn't know. I came in with real stories and they were making it up. And wow. And there's no substitute for that. It's like when cops come in and pitch stories about police, you go, "Whoa, that really happens." You know, it's so much better, right? So that's what began my television career. But I at the same time, met somebody who was an actor who wanted to pretend to be my agent. And this is, his name is Andrew Mathey, and he's still a friend, and he lives in Atlanta, but he was an actor. And he's been in a bunch of things, but not in Freddy's Nightmares that I've worked on. And Andrew ran into somebody else who was making a movie with Sal Mineo involved. And they introduced me to Sal, and Sal and I went off and wrote a movie together. We became extremely close friends. He was murdered on a day that he was actually supposed to be coming to my house out in Point Dune on the weekend. I heard through Sal a zillion stories about, you know, his years with James Dean and you know, what the 50s were like in film. And he knew everybody, knew absolutely everybody. He was a really dear guy. But also I learned a lot about filmmaking and storytelling from him, because as I would write a scene, he would play it for me and I'd know immediately whether the dialogue worked. If he couldn't deliver it, then it wasn't going to be looking held good on any better on, you know, anybody else's map. So after Doctor's Hospital, I started scrounging around for more television. But just because you write a couple of episodes doesn't mean you'll ever write other episodes. It's very different today, by the way, in television. Today, they have 6, 7, 8, 9 writers on staff and no freelance scripts at all. All the shows are written by in-house writers because all the shows are now serialized. Back then, no shows were serialized. It's very difficult to come in with a fresh story, an original story on a serialized show because you don't know what the arc is, right? And nobody's going to give you that material. In those days, you could come in with one-off stories. You know, somebody was a cop, they solve a crime. And boom, that got me to Beretta. Mike Butler and Chris Trumbo, who I mentioned to you earlier, Mike Butler was a friend of Robert Blake's. He had written a lot of Berettas. At that point, he and Chris had kind of split up. Chris and I remained friends. We actually lived next to each other in rental houses in Malibu, and Malibu is cheap. I mean, I was renting a house on the beach in Malibu for $350 a month. That piece of property today is worth $50 million.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's crazy. but Chris was there and Michael said, look, you know, I can help you. And he got me into the room in Beretta and I pitched an idea and I wrote the script. And the day after I handed in, Robert Blake himself called me and said, kid, come in, you're coming to work for me. And I drove in, and as I was driving on the lot at Universal, Tony Spinner, who is the exec producer who had bought the script, was driving off the lot and leaned out of his Cadillac Seville and said, good luck, and drove away. And as I drove up, I was taken down the hallway of the B building at Universal by Blake, and he showed me all the empty rooms and showed me all the people he had fired to make room for me so I could write every episode. Oh, and
no pressure.
And what, you know, when I say write every episode, rewrite most of the episodes because we were hiring freelance writers in those days. Problem was that you always, as a staff writer, you always wind up rewriting because people, they go off track, they go off tone. The dialogue is wrong. And I grew up in New York watching Million Dollar Movie and Movie for a Sunday Afternoon and all of those noir from wall to wall as a kid in New York on channels 9, 11, and 13. So I knew that dialogue. And Beretta was basically a 40s noir show, even though it was contemporary and it was about a cop. But Blake came from that generation. Remember, he was a five-year-old actor in Red Ryder playing Little Beaver, I think it was. He grew up in Little Rascals, an hour game, and it was street talk and it was New York kind of dialogue, and I was good at that. So writing things like "They don't make them like they used to," and that's the name of that tune, and you can take that to the bank, and all the other expressions they had came out of me naturally, whereas they were more stilted coming out of other people. But that was. For me, a very stressful period. I was under pressure all the time. I was doing horrible things to my body. I was taking things to keep me both awake and asleep. I was stressed out completely and finally decided I would leave the business. So I left Beretta and I moved up to Oregon where my college roommate was a professor at University of Oregon. This was in the late 70s. And what was he teaching? He was teaching computer science, which nobody was learning at the time.
Yeah.
And he had a little ranch in a town called Elkton, which had a population of 101. And he said, look, why don't you come up here and rest? And I did, and I ran out of money. And oddly enough, I became a kind of I was a law enforcement officer for a couple of years up in Oregon. Drug diversion is what my job was. And finally, when I turned 30, I thought, you know, it's time to grow up. And I turned around and moved back and went back to my first agent, Bill Hart, who took me back. I told him the whole story about what went on with me during those years. I called Chris Trumbo because I didn't think I could write by myself and asked him to come with me because they set up an appointment to pitch at Quincy, which was the Jack Klugman forensic show, which was basically the precursor for CSI. Right? It was a forensic investigator. Well, I owed everybody on Beretta money. I was borrowing money left and right to buy all the wrong things for myself. And when we got to the building where Quincy was, I see that the name on the wall was somebody who had been an associate producer on Beretta. And I said, Chris, I can't go in there. Now, this is Dalton Trumbo's son, mind you, right?
Yeah.
I said, I can't go in there because I owe this guy money. And through the screen, his name is Alan Godfrey, yelled out, Freilich, is that you getting here? So I went in. he closed the door. He sat down. He said, what happened? I told him the whole story about me and kind of falling apart and being scared and leaving the business and almost killing myself a zillion different times. And he looked at me and he said something that really resonated for the rest of my life. And I keep it in mind all the time when I have situations with people that make me angry in this business. And then I kind of stop and think about it sometimes. He looked at me and he said, we work in a business with a lot of damaged people. He said, if we can't find a way to forgive ourselves, no one else will. He said, so I'll give you a story and you'll pay me back. And he said, and everything will be fine again. And so he called Chris in. We pitched three stories to him. He called the tower, the Universal Tower, and he asked the controller to come down, Peter Thompson. We pitched him the story. They asked us to leave the room. We came back in, and they gave us a one-year overall deal at Universal.
Wow.
So the career that I'd thrown away was suddenly launched again. That was 1979. And since then, I've been lucky enough to be working in this business ever since without much of a break. I went the Universal route. You know, at Universal in those days, it was a lot like the old studio system days in features, where they kind of lock writers in a room. Writers were not allowed on set. They didn't really go to dailies much. Writers were never given the producer title. The executive producer was always either the person who created the show or what we now call the showrunner, but they didn't call it then. Mm-hmm. But you were a story editor or a writer, you know, or an executive story editor if you were really the head writer. We were executive story consultants on Quincy. But I went from Quincy to, I did some rewriting on Columbo as I worked on Mrs. Columbo. I finally wound up as a writer, and they gave me the producing credit on The Incredible Hulk. And I thought, wow, they gave me producing credit, means more money. No, it's the same exact money, only I got to ask questions that I couldn't answer by people in the crew. It was like, well, we got to shoot up there. I don't know. I don't know how to produce. Well, you have the title. But yeah, but that doesn't mean I know what I'm doing. I know how to write. I did Battlestar Galactica and Galactica 1980. I was in on the development of Magnum with Glenn Larson before he wound up partnering up with Don Bellisario. Did a couple of other things with Larson. Larson, to me, was a tremendous mentor. Even though Glenn Larson, whose nickname, by the way, was Glenn Larceny, because he would steal credit from people, or at least that was the legend. But my experience with Glenn was that, yeah, he would share credit with you after he did massive rewriting on your material and made it much better, right? He always made you look better. Your name was on it, but he thought it was fair to put his name on it too. I went on to run shows later on and made it a rule never to take the original writer's credit away. So I'm always giving credit to people. Jay Cappy used to complain to me about that because he would do so much work on other people's scripts. And I go, listen, man, you wouldn't want somebody taking your credit either. And without that writer, we wouldn't have had the idea. So after working at Universal, I went back to features and wrote a comedy at Disney. At the time, in the time between the Eisner Katzenberg group and the original Disney people, a guy named Tom Wilhite ran it, and they were making, at the time, on my floor in the animation building, Tron. Night Shift was just finished. Ron Howard was there, and he and Brian Grazer were developing Splash, and our movie, which was called Two Scoops, which was for Bill Murray, where he was going to play a National Enquirer reporter. It would have been the perfect role for him. And Tim Hunter was going to direct it, and I was writing it. And I must say, it was a really funny story. And he decided all of a sudden not to do comedy anymore. Bill Murray did. And he went off to do Razor's Edge, which was a complete bomb instead. So he passed on our film. But then I went back to TV, and I wound up at a company called Lorimar. And at Lorimar, which then became Lorimar Telepictures and then became Warner Brothers, this is the bulk of my career. For 14 years, I had an overall deal with that company. And I would develop every year, I would sell 5, 6, 7, 8 pilots. I would work on shows. A couple of them sold, a lot of them didn't. Sometimes I would have to hire people to write. Instead of my writing them, I would bring in great writers like Bob Crist other people to write ideas that I had. But it was a wonderful experience for me because next to me on one side was David Chase, and who was developing Sopranos in the 80s when nobody would buy it. And on the other side of me was Ed Zwick and Marshall Herskowitz, who were developing 30-something. And we would argue with each other over the thermostat because each of us had different body temperatures. But the thermostat was in my office, so it was like I held all the cards. But it was during that time that I wound up being what we now call a showrunner. Earl Hamner, who I had worked for on a couple of Lorimar shows, one of them called Boone, which was basically the story of Elvis Presley, but we didn't call him Elvis. He was a fictionalized Elvis. Took place in the 50s in Tennessee. Tom Bird played the lead. They had a wonderful supporting cast of people, but it was about a young kid who grows up on a combination of gospel and country and makes it rock and roll, right? So it's everything you saw in Elvis, only on a smaller scale and not as pretty, but and without the name, which I think helped the movie a lot. I think the other thing that I did for them was Flamingo Road for a couple of years, which was a lot of fun. It was a nighttime soap opera. But 1980 is when the nighttime soap opera hit, and television changed dramatically. What used to be absolutely forbidden, which was serializing shows, became more attractive. Nighttime soap operas, which were Flamingo Road, which is the least known of all of them, Dallas, Knott's Landing, Falcon Crest were the other three Lorimar shows, and then Dynasty was over there at Aaron Spelling. And then Hill Street Blues, because that was also a serialized show, and Sing Elsewhere. There were a bunch of shows which decided, we're going to get your attention and you're never going to want to leave us and you're going to watch us every single week. And it was called appointment television. But you couldn't miss one because you would miss a lot of the story.
Yeah.
The problem that they had with those shows is that they made for difficult summer reruns. We did 28 episodes of those shows, and there are 56 weeks in the year. So we had to pick our favorite 20 or 24 to rerun and fill in the blanks with little trailers. But Earl retired. He had created Falcon Crest, and he had decided to retire, and he wanted me to take over for him. And I, along with a vice president in charge of creative affairs at Lorimar, her name was Joanne Bruh, who was a good friend of Jane Wyman's, who was the star of the show, and an older woman, which was really important to the sensibility of the show, because I'm coming in, and I'm a noir guy, right? I'm going to turn Falcon Crest into a very different kind of show, and Joanne kept me kind of honest. But the first thing I did when I took over Falcon Crest, and I was, by the way, let me tell you, I'm sorry if I'm going on forever about this.
Great. But
I
was fine, yeah.
My stun at the time, this is 1986. My son was 3.5, and 85 is when it was. And he got chickenpox. So I got chickenpox. I'd never had chickenpox. I've never been that sick in my life. I am an adult in the 30s. I was in my mid-30s. Getting chickenpox was like a death blow. And I'm in bed, and I'm feeling horrible. And the phone rings, and it's Lee Rich, who owns Lorimar at the time. Lorimar was owned by three people. Lee Rich, who was the front man, came from the ad business, had been an executive producer of television shows when advertising and TV kind of worked together a lot. Shows were presented by one sponsor. The guy with the money behind him was a guy named Merv Adelson, who was probably connected to the underworld somehow. And his other backer was Aaron Mulaski, who was another person who had, you know, been written about as being a gangster, but I have no proof that any of that was true. It's yeah. Just that it probably was, you know, but it didn't matter to me. They were really nice to me. But Lee, who was known in the ad business as the mouse that gored, calls me up because he yelled a lot, right? Gets on the phone and says, Earl Hamner's retiring. He wants you to take over Falcon Crest. And I am on so much medication, I can barely speak English. And I don't know what the fuck he's talking about. And I actually, what Falcon Crest? I've never watched Falcon Crest. I don't know. I can't take over a show I've never watched. It had already done 5 seasons, right? I can't.
Oh, man.
And he said, sit tight. I said, I can't go anywhere. About a half an hour later, there's a knock at the door, and this giant Teamster was there with a box. And he handed me this box that was really heavy. And in the box were 28 VHS cassettes, the entire season 5 of Falcon Crest in the box. So I take the last episode. I can barely make it out of bed, barely make it back to the bedroom, stick this thing in the machine, got into bed. Next thing I know, the phone's ringing, and I was asleep. And I got waken up, and it's Lee going, what do you think? I said, I fell asleep during the main title. He said, see what I mean? The show needs a goose. It really is. It really needs some help. He said, so what is it going to take to make you do this? Now, I am delirious, and I have no filter whatsoever. I have little enough filter as it is now as an adult. But boy, then on all those drugs, I had no filter at all. And I said, I want to be the highest paid person on the show. I want all the money paid above and beyond my overall guarantee. I want no notes from you guys at all at Lorimore. He said, done. I said, and I want no notes from CBS either. I want to make the show completely autonomously. And Lee Rich said to me, my favorite quote, and I've said it to showrunners ever since then. He said, fuck CBS. If they're such geniuses, everything they put on the air would be a hit. And if you do what they tell you to do and it fails, they're going to blame you. And if you do what you want and it succeeds, they're going to take the credit anyway. So fuck them. I'll keep them away from you. So how can you say no to that?
Yeah.
Right? So I said, I'm going to change the show a lot. He said, you do whatever you want, but I'm going to give you Joanne Brough because she's like a Bible of the show. She knows everything and she's friends with Jane. And I loved her. She was always very supportive to me. She was like another mother to me in a way. And I was very happy to have that happen. And as I was lying in bed, I thought, how can I make Falcon Crest better? I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to make it a noir half-lit show. I'm going to write scenes that are only a page or a page and a half long instead of 5 pages long. The way it was shot in those days, they flipped on the lights and they shot it like a daytime soap opera. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to get rid of a lot of the actors who I thought had dull characters, keep the core, the best core, and bring on a cavalcade of all the actors I've always wanted to meet. You know, and I'll come over the character for them. But the key to it all was I wanted to make Vertigo for 28 episodes. So Joanne and I got on a plane and we flew to Monterey and we got Kim Novak, who is living with her husband, who is a veterinarian. And I said, I want to do Vertigo for 28 hours. And this time you can play 3 characters if you want. And I want to invite you to be part of telling me the story. And I want to shoot part of it in San Francisco. And I want you to take me on a tour of San Francisco and show me all the places that you shot Vertigo and all the things that you and Jimmy Stewart did together. And we're going to make this show Vertigo. And that's what we did. So Kim came on the show, which made Jane Wyman a little jealous, I must say. But on the other hand, she was still very gracious to her. I brought on a kind of a parade of terrific people. One day I woke up and I said, I wanted to cast a whole bunch of children of famous people. And this is how Mariska Hargitay got her start. Mariska came in, read from me. She was a teenager. I thought she'd be a great bratty teenager. And that was her first role. But I got other people that I always wanted to work with. Leslie Caron, I'd been a big Gigi fan. I looked at so she came and worked on the show. Ed Marinaro was a golf partner. I got him off the Hill Street to come and do work with me. But a lot of really incredible people. Ursula Andress, Buck Henry, Lauren Hutton. The list is crazy long of good actors, and I don't need to go into that. But it gave me a taste of what it was like to make television. And then there was one kind of magical day where it was a Monday. The producer, the line producer, as we call them now, called me from the set and said that the director hadn't shown up yet, that his car broke down in San Diego where he was for the weekend, and that everybody was standing around. It was an episode. I wrote 7 of the 28 episodes that year. I wrote 14 in the first 2 seasons that I was on that show. But I'd never directed in my life since college. And he said, we need somebody to direct. I said, well, don't you have a friend who can come down and fill in for the day? It was an incredibly complicated cat and mouse team by an elevator bank of 8 different elevators with people coming in and out of it and just barely missing each other and all the rest. And he said, why don't you do it? Why don't you? You have the right. I had the power to hire myself as a director. So, and I never really considered that. And I said, okay, fine. I was just going to hire myself for that one day. Well, give a mouse a cookie. So I went down there. And I'm shooting the scene, but what I don't know, because writers, and that's a good reason why writers should be on the set more often, not for their input, just so they can see how things are made. Because when you write, you have no idea what it's going to take to shoot what you write, unless you've seen what it takes to shoot anything. So I went down on set and I'm shooting this in pieces as if I'm cutting it, right? Close up of her coming out, wider shot of her coming out, turning the corner, her point of view, right? And I'm like 12 setups into this. Now I'm doing it quickly. I'm not like being precious about every shot. And Jane Wyman, who had won Oscars and is standing there and didn't like me much yet to begin with, because she hadn't seen a finished show yet. She didn't like the fact that I came in and made everybody work longer. She didn't like that I brought Kim Novak onto the show. She didn't like that I introduced a lot of violence to the show because Kim Novak was on the run from Robert Stack and was in, and comes in masquerades as Cesar Romero's daughter, which is part of the Vertigo thing, right? She gaslights everybody at Falcon Crest and in the Napa Valley. And he stops and she goes, one second. And I go, what? And now you got a picture of Jane Wyman. I don't know if you know what she looked like, but she was miniature. She weighed like 90 pounds. She wore very high heels, but she wasn't particularly tall, but she was incredibly strong. And remember, this was Ronald Reagan, who was the sitting president at the time in the 80s. This is his ex-wife, right? Standing there. And she says to me in front of the whole crew, what is this? Tiny Tots movie making? And I come, what, Jane? She said, this is television, darling. There isn't time for all of this. So I said, well, I'm trying to, I don't care what you're trying to do. She said, there's a better way to do it. Now, this is in front of Kim Novak, Eddie Albert, Cesar Romero, Lorenzo Lamas. I mean, the list is really long. Yeah. And I have never been that humiliated, right? And she still hasn't seen the first episode cut together yet. So she's still on the fence about whether I'm the worst thing that ever happened to the show. Or, and anyway, I quickly learned, I took her aside and I said that I needed help. Because I hadn't spent a lot of time on set. I said, you know, remember, writers are locked in their rooms in television and we don't really come down here. And she said, okay. She said, but you've cut the show. I said, oh, absolutely. She said, then remember what you've been cutting from. You don't get every shot individually, you know. And it seemed like such an obvious thing, but she was trying to impress upon me that as opposed to novels, screenwriting was shorthand. And as opposed to screenwriting, television is even more shorthand, right? Because you have less time to tell just as complicated a story. So it's an interesting difference in the art form itself. About a week later, I got a bottle of Chardonnay and a 3/4-inch version of the final version of the first episode that we had made and went to Jane Wyman's dressing room and sat down with her and poured her a glass of wine and watched this show that featured Kim Novak escaping from Bob Stack and making her way to Falcon Crest and all the rest. She didn't say a word for the 45 minutes that was on. And at the end, she got up and turned to me, took a sip, and I'm shuddering. And she said, now that's a show I would watch.
That is so cool. I'm getting
a big hug. And suddenly filled me with all kinds of confidence. And it paid off later in the year. I was shooting. I had come up with a story that Howard Lakin, our supervising producer, wrote the script for, but I was directing it. It was more of an Agatha Christie thing. It all took place in Falcon Crest. The entire cast, 20 people locked because of a storm in this place. It was very, very complicated. It was a fun episode. But the younger cast, it was a Friday night, we had rain effects on the stage, and they were all complaining. They didn't know that Jane and I were sitting together close by, and we could hear her complaining that they had plans, and we were going to work late at night, and I'm getting carried away. And she got the idea to get everybody together and quieted everybody down. She stood in the middle of everybody, and she said, I have worked with all of them, Hitchcock, Wilder, Wyler, Hawks, this and that, and none of them ever worked as hard as this man here. And if I can be here at 8 o'clock on a Friday night, so can you. So I don't want to hear any more of it. And everybody went, oh, okay, Jane, and they walked away. And I was floored. But what I think I'm aiming toward now, just as a general kind of thing about filmmaking, and you know it, you're both filmmakers and lovers of film, but it's a team sport. There's nobody, even though the French love to talk about the auteur, and you know, we've seen a film by as a credit for years now, the possessory credit the directors take. It is an art form made by a large number of people, including PAs, who sometimes have great ideas, but sometimes if they make a mistake, the whole thing collapses, and sometimes they find a solution to something nobody else can find. Yeah. So the point is that it's like Steve Jobs said, if you hear a good idea, do it. The worst that can happen is you have to undo it, but it's better than not doing anything, 100%. Right? And when you're making film, you rely on absolutely everybody. And so it was really important. That speech that she made was very important in enlisting everybody who was on that stage, 150 crew people and 20 cast people, to work toward the same goal. And yeah, I was calling action and maybe I had written the show, but it was predating monitors, right? So today I can sit on a set and watch every shot. And if I don't like what's going on, I can go talk to the director and say, you know, this is what we had in mind. In those days, it was a handoff, a series of creative handoffs. The writer would write a script and hand it to the director. The director would interpret it and hand it to the actors. The actors would do their own interpretation of it. Ultimately, it would wind up in the hands of the editor. It would go through the cinematographer and the operators, who would create shots that would be surprises to you the next day in dailies. You'd go into a screen room where you'd sit in your room and look at it on cassette, and you'd go, wow, he got a different shot than I asked for, but it's even better. Or sometimes, he didn't get what I wanted. And sometimes he'd add, or she would add, a shot that nobody asked for, but was really great. And I remember several occasions where I'd go back down to the set and talk to the operator and say, hey, I didn't know you got it. He said, I thought you'd like it. And I said, oh, I love it. It's great. Thanks. And it's because nobody can think about all those things all at once. Nobody has the right answers to everything all at once. You know, and I find it amazing that certain people take 100% credit for an art form that was never conceived to be a one-man band. You know, this is really, it's a team sport. So Falcon Crest introduced me to being the boss. Yeah. That was, you know, really what it meant. And my credit was executive producer, and which is generally what the showrunner credit is. It is what my credit has been on almost everything else I've done since then. But after Falcon Crest, now we come to our podcast. I finished Falcon Crest. I did season 6 and 7 of Falcon Crest, and we wrapped that up in the spring of 1988. I was doing incredibly well, and my wife and I at that point had 2 kids, and we wanted our children to go to good public schools, because private schools in Los Angeles, it's like, what car did you get for your 6th birthday? Yeah. You know, and it's very, you know, it instills values, or at least this is our feeling, that it instilled values that we didn't support in kids. We wanted them to go to school with all sorts of people. We wanted to learn that the world is filled with different kinds of people. We wanted them to not feel entitled. And we figured that if they did well enough, they'd get into good colleges anyway. You didn't need to pay $40,000 a year to get into a good college when you're paying $40,000 a year for third grade. You know, it doesn't make any sense. So we moved to, but the price that you pay for moving to a place like where I live now, Santa Monica, is that the houses were really expensive. So what you pay in property tax and for the house itself more than makes up for the fact that you're giving your kids maybe a better education and a better environment to live in. And so I went deep into Hawk, but I had a long-term deal at Lorimar, so I knew I was going to get a salary for the next 3 years. And it wasn't 2 weeks after we moved into this house that we're in now, 35 years later, that the Writers Guild went on strike. And it went on strike for the longest time in the history of the Writers Guild. And don't quote me on this, but I believe it was 27 weeks. It could have been longer. But I was a long-term member of the Writers Guild. By the way, I joined the Writers Guild in the early 70s, and a week after I joined the Guild, we went on strike. So it was constantly, but those strikes are important. The first strike was for pension, the other one's for healthcare. This one was for, I don't remember at the time, I think it was VHS cassettes, but we went on strike. So the studios often use strikes, and we're coming up on a new negotiation, a potential Writers Guild strike this year. But sometimes the studios use strikes as an opportunity to cut ties with people who are making a lot of money, who can't work during the strike, which is most people, because everything basically shuts down. And especially expensive writing deals, they call that part of the contract force majeure, when F-O-R-C-E-M-A-J-E-U-R, is when something that is out of their control happens, you know, an act of God, basically, so strike. And they're allowed to suspend you or cut you. In my case, they did what they call suspend and extend, which is, we are going to stop paying you today. You can stop coming to work, because my job was primarily as a writer, even though I was the producer and the director, I was generating material for them, which I wouldn't do anymore. And they would extend my contract by the number of weeks or months at the end that the strike continued and kept me out of work. So I would still get all that money down the line, but when it was going to happen. In the meantime, we had to take out loans to pay mortgages and stuff like that. One day in the middle of the strike, I got a call. This was also an interesting time politically at Lorimar. Lorimar had been an incredibly successful independent television company that made Eight is Enough, The Waltons, Falcon Crest Dallas, Knott's Landing. They had a feature division that made The Last Starfighter and Perfect and a couple of other movies. And they were merging with a smaller company that made mostly reality game shows and some comic stuff called Telepictures. So it was going to count Lorimar Telepictures. They were an exclusively non-union company, Telepictures. That's what their history had been. All the stuff that they made didn't include SAG, WGA, DGA, or IATSE people or Teamsters. And I got a call from the new co-president. Lee Rich shared the office of president with a guy named David Salzman, who was one of the three partners in Telepictures, and called me up and asked me to come in and discuss a new project. They were talking to Warner Brothers about an eventual merger, which actually did happen. Warner Brothers took over Lorimar Telepictures and New Line. New Line, which had only made, at that point, Nightmare on Elm Street. They were about to launch production on the fourth Nightmare on Elm Street that Rennie Harlan directed. But they had done the third one, and it was successful. And Bob Shea, a former lawyer from Detroit, owned this company, New Line, 100%. Like, all the money from the movies came right out of his pocket. And they thought it would be a good idea to make Nightmare on Elm Street into a television show, syndicate it, and wanted me to come up with an idea for it. I said, I can't do that. There's a writer's strike going on right now, right? Well, they said, we already did. They had, without my knowing it, put together a group of non-union people to come up with stories and scripts. They brought in a guy named Scott Stone, who is kind of a reality show producer, to produce it, to exec produce it. They brought in Gil Adler, who is a low-budget producer, hadn't really ever done this kind of thing before. Mike DeLuca was kind of an intern who was just kind of turning a corner into being a creative exec at New Line, newly out of NYU. And they had enlisted the reluctant help of, and he didn't completely put his foot in, a feature writer, Jonathan Betchul, who had written The Last Starfighter. But, and they got a bunch of scripts from non-union writers, and they asked me to read them. And I thought, okay, let me see what I might be getting into. And I said, but mind you, I'm not doing any work on the show until the strike is over. And they said, no, of course not, of course not. I'm not going to ask you to do something you can't morally do. I said, it's not even a moral issue. You're not paying. We'll pay you if you come back. You know, I'm not going to do that yet, right? Not yet. Not until I'm really desperate do I want to do that. I was, by the way, the chairman of the Writers Guild Strike Disciplinary Committee years before that, where my job was to find people who were working during the strike. So I wasn't about to go down that road. And I read the scripts, and they were horrible. And I got to tell you, you didn't even know what the show was. Nobody knew what to do with Freddie. They made Freddie into like a stand-up comic. It was horrible, and the stories were horrible. And you know, to me, I was never a big horror fan, but I was a fan of Nightmare on Elm Street. And the reason I loved Wes Craven's and I liked the second two was because it had an underpinning of reality that to have dreams haunt you and to have those dreams manifest themselves in reality, with or without a Freddy Krueger, it doesn't really matter. It's terrifying because we all have those dreams. Everybody has had this falling dream where you're jumping off a building or falling out of an airplane or whatever it is. Everybody is in fear of death in the middle of their dream. A lot of people have woken up in a cold sweat and go, thank God that was only a dream. And yet here was something that tapped into that basic human fear, which was losing control. Going to sleep is losing control. And so then the question is, what do you do as a television show? So I went back to my roots with Rod Serling and Twilight Zone. And I came up with, without discussing with anybody there, the idea that what we would do is have Freddy Krueger, in a clever way somehow, using visual effects, introduce the shows to tell you, here's somebody who's afraid of taking the SAT. Here's somebody who's afraid of getting into, and they're not going to get into a sorority. Here's somebody who's afraid they just got married. Here's somebody who's afraid that they're going to overeat. You know, so tap into that fear. Have Freddy introduce what the fear is. So we know that Freddy's going to have something to do with that nightmare that person has. And so I thought that would be a kind of good idea, a good way to do it. Now, how can I integrate Freddy into the show? So I started to meet with Bob Shea. And I was willing to meet with Bob Shea. This is, again, writer's strike going on. I'm willing to talk conceptually, but I'm not willing to do anything beyond that. But I wanted to know what the rules were, because I was told that Bob was very concerned that we were going to ruin his legacy. And Bob's biggest concern was that he was only making Nightmare on Elm Street movies, and if we overused Freddy in the television show, the people wouldn't want to spend the money to come to the theaters. So I had to kind of make a deal with him, kind of like the Pope made the deal between Spain and Portugal about South America. Or here's a line we'll draw down. You guys get that side. You know, in my case, it was like, okay, how many Freddy shows do you have to have? I said, well, the pilot. And maybe two more after that. And he said, okay, out of 22 hours, you can have Freddy three times integrated as a character in the show like he is in the movies. The others, he just has to be on a box of cereal, waving, whatever it may be, rolling out from under a car, doing whatever it is that he did. And that became the delight, I thought, for the audience, which is, where is he going to show up next?
100%.
Well, boom, there he is, right? And that was actually the most difficult part of writing the shows, which is to make those moments special and different. And Robert Englund, by the way, also had some ideas that were pretty terrific. He was part of the whole process. I'll go back to the team sport. This was not all my brainchild, and I want to say that, but I'll tell you how everybody else did get involved. So the strike was ending. Now I was willing to meet with writers, but real writers. I didn't want to talk to the people who had written the bad scripts. I wanted to bring in writers that I knew. John Betchelow was a friend. He lived a couple of blocks away. Our kids knew each other. My daughter and his daughter are communicating via social media to this very day. They're both known Molly. And so Betchelow became my kind of right-hand man. He was the supervising producer. I was the executive producer along with Bob Shea. We share that credit. Scott Stone kind of stayed the businessman on the side. I insisted on making the entire show union for SAG, DGA, and Writers Guild, but it stayed non-union for the crew because we were kind of somehow allowed to do that because Scott Stone had a non-union agreement. And so we weren't going to get picketed. And the only way we could make the show for less than $500,000 an hour, which, to put it in perspective, is less than 10% of what the average hour of television costs today. Average hour of television costs at least $5 million. That show was made for $500,000. Now, here came the biggest problem. And I heard you guys kind of conjecturing why we did it this way and how this happened. the next shoe to fall off was I met Dick Robertson. Dick Robertson was the president of Warner Brothers Syndication and one of the three Telepictures partners. Dick Robertson had a bronze plaque behind him, behind his desk, that said, definition of net profits. There are no net profits, right? Dick Robertson was like, because I had net profits on the show. I see this behind him and I go, fuck, I'm never going to see a dollar on the show after. He's telling me in advance, at least it's fair warning. But what Dick said to me was, look, he said, you know, we have to sell this into syndication. I said, look, the show that I'm going to make, and we haven't really discussed it, and you haven't read anything, you haven't seen it. This is not for kids. This is a show that needs to be on at 10 o'clock at night. He said, okay, we'll work on that. But he said that, you know, it sells to different times in every different market, and we can't, it doesn't, it's not like a network show where you sell 10 o'clock on Thursday at CBS. This is going to be every individual city gets sold differently. He said, but what's really important is that down the road, we want to be able to split these into half hours. And I said, well, that's impossible. As a writer, I don't know how you do that. What you're asking me to make is 44 episodes that each take 2.5 to 3 days to shoot, that each cost $250,000. And he said, I guess that's what I'm asking you. And I walked out of the office feeling hopeless. And by the time I got home, I had an idea, which is why you see what you saw. What if we hire the same director, the same writer, and the same cast to play two different stories? Okay, that's a start. Try to duplicate some of the sets that maybe we had to build or draft for each show, but make it two different, completely different fears that these people have. Everybody has more than one fear.
That's the end of part one of our Jeff Frylich interview. And I hope you've enjoyed it, because this is the kind of deep in the filmmaking trenches information you never get to hear anywhere. But make sure you're back here next week to hear part two, where Jeff goes deep into the experience of being a head writer and executive producer on Freddy's Nightmares. There's so much great stuff coming right up. But until next time, thanks for listening, and you can email us at freddysnightmarespod@gmail.com, and make sure to like, subscribe, review, all of that good stuff, but be back here next week for part two of Jeff Frylich's interview, because boy, I'm nerding out. It's awesome.